And the kids at John Paul, you know, were told at an assembly to be careful, but I don't think anyone, including Natalie Russell, thought that this would happen at 2:30 on a Friday afternoon on your way home from school.
When three women were stalked and brutally killed in the Melbourne suburban area of Frankston 25 years ago, police feared they had a serial killer on the loose. It was a terrifying time, and author Vicky Petratis had a front seat to the investigation.
This is Australian True Crime. Come with us as we explore how people become killers, how people become victims, and what happens next.
Vicky's book, The Frankston Murders, has been updated and re-released, and we talked to her about her experience of writing about such a high-profile investigation. Excited to have Vicky Petratis back with us. The episode we did with you on the Phillip Island murder was so popular, and I know you are one of my favourite authors. I still remember when I borrowed the Frankston Murders book from the Ringwood Library back when I was, might have been 15 or 16, but I remember vividly reading it and just being amazed at what a great book it was. It was so in depth, but also just having the Frankston murders are ones that are sort of permeated into our minds living in Melbourne. It's a horrific crime, and it's now 25 years on, and you have updated your best-selling book, and you're here to talk to us about it. Now, we did speak to Charlie Bezina, our good friend Charlie, a while ago about the investigation, but let's touch on today your experience, because you were very much became part of the story. Tell us a little bit about how did you actually come to write about the Frankston murders?
I was writing my second book, which was after the Phillip Island murder. When I did that book, all the police that I interviewed said to me, oh, if this book doesn't work out, come back. We've got fantastic stories. So I thought, I don't know whether you remember the feeling of when you finish writing your first book, there's just this void that's, what do I do with myself? And you either hand sand your floors or paint the walls, or you go, I've got to fill this with more writing. And so I contacted the police who I'd interviewed for Phillip Island, and I said, well, what are other stories that you've got? And from that, everything changed. So if you read the first book, Brian Gamble Does the Crime Scene, and then if you read my second book, which was called Victims, Crimes and Investigators, there's a story about him when he examines the Rye crossbow murder scene. So there's so much cross-pollination because you meet these people and you form professional relationships with them, and they really liked having their story told and they were more than happy to tell other stories. So what happened was I was doing some ride-alongs with the Frankston police to write stories about typical policing nights. And as a resident of Seaford, I certainly had never seen my surrounding suburbs at 3 a.m. when the pubs closed. So I was on ride-alongs with the Frankston police, and I did a ride-along with the CIB. I did a shift with the community policing squad. And that's how, on the 30th of July 1993, I came to be at the scene of Natalie Russell's murder. So I was doing an evening shift with a sergeant who was my next-door neighbour, Mick. And so we got to the police station, and it was right in the middle of this investigation. So the police everywhere from all over Melbourne. And when we got to we parked around the back and we were walking through the back entrance, and there was all lots of cops out there having a smoko, and when we walked up, one said, another one's gone missing, and then another cop said, right under our bloody noses. Mm. It was like this pall was hanging over the police station. They couldn't believe that with all of their efforts, and my next-door neighbour Mick said, you know, what kind of girl was she? And I make the point in the introduction for the new book that's every feminist's prickle question.
Yeah.
But I realised what he was saying, what he meant. It was cop speak for, is she the kind of girl not to come home on time? Is she the kind of girl that might sort of disappear and turn up later? And they said, no, she's a school kid and her parents are really worried. So by the time we had walked inside and someone had come down from upstairs where all of the bosses were, and he just, there was no emotion, I'll never forget it. And he said, they found her and she's dead. And it's like they couldn't believe that there wasn't even enough room left for emotion. It was sucked out of that whole building. And so it was no lights, no sirens going to the scene. So my neighbour, and maybe if he hadn't have been my neighbour, it might not have happened, but he said, right, you're in the back seat, just keep your head down. we'll drive there. You're not going to get out of the car. And so I found myself at the car park of the Monterey High School, which was at the other end of the bike track, sitting in the back seat of the car with my notebook in this drizzling rain, staring up at the police helicopter, light shining down on where the body lay in one of the golf courses, thinking, I have to write this book. I'm right here. So I'm not sure that there are many crime writers that could find themselves in that position. So,
and as you've said before, I've heard you when we've done talks, you really wouldn't find yourself in that position today, of the way you couldn't just get in the back of a cop car and go on a ride along. So it was a really unique time and opportunity, wasn't it?
Yeah. And also, crime writing back then, 25 years ago, was a novelty. Mm. So as far as I knew, there were, I think, two titles around, and one of them was Andrew Rule's Cuckoo.
Yes.
And which all crime writers have read. Yeah. It's a fabulous book. Yeah. And Tom Noble had just put out Untold Violence. Yeah. So that was about it, that really no one, to my knowledge, was looking at local crime and saying, this needs a spotlight too. The newspapers did it, so it was front page of every newspaper, but nobody was at that time thinking to come along and say, this deserves a book, this deserves an account that tells the whole story, not just the screaming headlines.
And you really have captured it in this book. But a lot of our listeners will be familiar with the Frankston murders, but we do have a lot of international listeners now. So can you just give us background? What were these murders? Who were the victims?
The first victim, Elizabeth Stevens, was killed in June. So this went over a period of 7 weeks. So June 1993. And Elizabeth, the police thought, but they never knew, they thought she had gone to Frankston, that was her plan, and they thought that she'd caught the bus home and that someone had snatched her on the bus because she was found in Langwarrin in parkland behind where her aunt and uncle lived and she was living with them. So they assumed that she had made it home, but the bus driver never remembered seeing her on the bus, and so that was just, they surmised that she got off the bus and someone grabbed her. She was dumped. It was a rainy night. She had strange markings carved into her chest. She hadn't been sexually assaulted, and the police were at a loss. The only thing that they had to maybe investigate was that she had been followed a couple of weeks earlier, and she'd come in from the bus and she ran in, and her uncle told me that she was terrified, and she said, I think someone's following me. So he'd gone out to have a look, couldn't see anyone, but she certainly was really fearful. So they thought, is someone stalking her? Has someone been following her home? And then a couple of weeks later, the two things happened on the 8th of July. This is a really big time for this case. So Debbie Freem was taken. She had a 12-day-old baby. But earlier in the night, a woman had gotten off the train at Seaford, and a big young guy had grabbed her and tried to drag her toward a toilet block near the railway station. And she had fought him, and she'd managed to escape and ran out onto the road, and someone stopped and she jumped into their car, and a young woman had driven her home and they rang the police. So what they think the killer did is hopped back on the train at Seaford, gone down to Debbie Freem lived in Cannanook, Cannanook Avenue, and they think that he just got off at the next station and started to stalk again. So she had invited a friend around to see her 12-day-old baby cooking dinner, ran out of milk and said, I'll just drive up to the street. The milk bar was in the same street as her house. And she said, I'll just pop up to the shop and grab some milk. And she never came home. So that was... And I was actually doing a shift with a community policing squad when she was missing, and her car had just been found. So I was in the offices when they were all talking about, initially it was seen as maybe she had postnatal depression, maybe she couldn't cope with the baby, because nobody jumps to serial killer as a solution to where could this young mother had gone. Yeah. And her family and friends are saying, but no, she loved the baby and she wasn't under any kind of pressure. She didn't have any signs of postnatal depression or signs that she wasn't coping. She was delighting in this baby. And her car had just been found and the seat was pushed all the way back. And for the first time, the police were really concerned because they said, she's short. Someone tall has driven this car who's not her. So 4 days later, her body was found, you know, at a sort of bushland in Seaford adjoining a farm, and a farmer had found it. And the same MO, even though she didn't have patterns carved into her body like the first victim. What she did have was that there was no sign of sexual assault. There was stab wounds, so a knife had been the weapon of choice, and that her body was barely concealed. So there was sort of a branch over it, but it was found the minute anyone was in the vicinity, they found the body. So when they brought in FBI-trained profiler Claude Minasini, who trained under John Douglas, he was a member of the Victoria Police, when they brought him in, he very quickly said, we've got women snatched off the street, the victim selection is young, female, a knife is a weapon, no sexual assault. And while the police were reluctant to join the two investigations, just in case they're not connected, I think in Claude's mind, he said to me, I said to them, how many men are there in this area killing women at any given time statistically? So what are the odds that you'd have two? So he knew just from the pattern of this that there was one offender, or that was his, he suspected. He'd actually come up with a map as to where this offender might live, and he was spot on. Of course, the police would then say, it doesn't help us catch him, but it certainly helped them narrow down who they were looking for. So I think Claude had profiled a younger offender. Sometimes, you know, we might think, oh, the guy, you know, we might be looking for someone in their 30s or 40s. But Danny was 21. And so Claude had pretty much nailed the profile, but it didn't help, unfortunately. It doesn't help because these are stranger murders and it could be anyone. So by the time I was doing the night shift with my next door neighbour Mick, it was 7 weeks into this killing spree. Everybody was frightened. The newspaper headlines were screaming, corridor of death, serial killer in Frankston. And the kids at John Paul, you know, were told at an assembly to be careful, but I don't think anyone, including Natalie Russell, thought that this would happen at 2:30 on a Friday afternoon on your way home from school. And so she walked down the bike path. Denya, it was one of those awful, could have been a near miss, but it wasn't. Denya was parked opposite the bike track across the road, and a postal worker had seen him in the car. And the fact that so many people were frightened, she had driven past him. He had given her the heebie-jeebies to the extent that she had gone and knocked on someone's door and said, I need to use your phone to ring the police. There's a guy that looks really suspicious sitting in a car. So she went inside, rang the police. By the time the police got there, the car was still there, but he was gone. So in that really short space of time, Natalie had walked up to the bike track. Denya had seen her approach. He had ducked down the bike track, and he'd been up there earlier and he'd cut several holes in. So he jumped through a hole, waited till she had walked past. So as far as she can see, you can see from one end of the bike track to the other. So she thinks that she's walking down an empty bike track, and he jumps out and grabs her and pulls her through a hole further down. So it was all very planned. Her murder was really brutal. And then, you know, her body was discovered, and evidence at her crime scene helped the police to catch him the very next day. Because what happened was the two cops that had checked the car, the minute that they saw, that they heard that a girl had been found down that bike track, they went straight up to the bosses and said, but we checked a car right when she would have been walking up. So they had him the next day, and he had certain cuts and abrasions on him that as soon as he opened the door, they looked at his hands and they went, yeah, we've got him. Mm. So it was a cat and mouse in the interview process, and then he finally confessed in the wee hours of the Sunday morning.
That case, even today, and I know we've had comments from people, they do the same with what happened to Debbie Freem. Every time I get in my car, I actually reach over the back seat and I just feel around. I think there's probably a lot of people who think about these murders and Debbie and baby Jake. It just the thought, especially since I've had my own kids now, the thought of being separated from your child is just horrific. So you've updated the book. It's 25 years on. Now, what, since you first published it and it has been a perennial kind of bestseller, what has been added to this book to mark the 25 years?
I wanted to mark the 25 years because when I first interviewed people for the book, Elizabeth Stevens' uncle said to me, he said, when Paul Denyer ever steps out of jail, I will be waiting with a whole lot of friends of mine We'll be waiting and we will make sure he never leaves the car park. Natalie Russell's aunt Bernadette, who became a really good friend of mine, and she's since died. She said to me, you know, I'll be there and I'll be reminding people when it comes close to, because Paul Denyer got a 30-year non-parole period. So originally he got life, and then on appeal that was lowered to, he got a non-parole period. So as the 25 years gets closer, I realised that the people that were going to champion this and keep it in the public eye might not be with us any longer. And I thought, it's my responsibility to wave this around and say, don't ever forget what he did. Paul Denyer now identifies as female and identifies as Paula Denyer. So as Paula Denyer, in 5 years' time, may well come before a parole board, and she might say, but I've led a blameless life in prison, and I was 21, I'm now, you know, 56, and I deserve a second chance. I guess luckily, and I mean this with all respect to the victim, but Paula Denyer had been charged with sexually assaulting someone in prison. And when I read that, while my heart went out to the victim, I also thought, you are still showing your true colours, and you are still showing that you are a predator, so that when you do come before the parole board, that you cannot say, I have led a blameless life in prison. Because serial killers often do, and anyone who reads widely on this topic, as no doubt your listeners will know that in prison they can often, when deprived of victims, given regular hours and regular habits and regular nutrition, that they can lead a blameless life. Mm. But, you know, the few cases in America where these people have been let out, they have reoffended, and Paula Denyer is very dangerous in my mind. So I wanted to be the one in lieu of these family members not being able to do it, I wanted to be the one that says never forget.
After the break, Vicky tells us more about baby Jake, the hidden victim of these murders.
And of course, 25 years down the track, there's a whole bunch of people that this case is not within their living memory. You know, when Princess Diana died and everybody can say, 1997, I remember that.
Yep.
And now, of course, you might say to kids, it's school now, you know, Princess Diana, and oh yeah, I think I've read about her.
Yeah.
So she's not in their living memory.
That's right.
And, you know, she was 1997, this was 1993. The same thing happens, that you have a whole generation of people coming up that don't remember when this happened, that don't remember the front page headlines, that don't remember the sorrow over baby Jake, and that, you know, his dad Gary Blair holding him, and the whole of Victoria looking at those pictures thinking, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
With this tiny newborn baby and his little fuzzy black hair, I think everybody remembers. But life had thrown him so many curveballs. It made it really difficult for him to live the life that he could have lived had his mother not have been taken. Mm. And so it occurred to me all over again that he was this hidden victim, that here is this young man who was only 12 days old when his mother died, and he now has a diminished life because of Denyer's choice 25 years ago. So I ended up interviewing him for the book, and his story will break your heart.
It is absolutely heartbreaking, and I think so many people have wondered what has happened to baby Jake.
Yeah.
How's he going? And even, you know, how did Gary go? You know, how did he pick up the pieces of his life in the wake of Debbie's murder? It's just, I guess when people think about Paula Denyer getting parole, you're absolutely right. You cannot forget the absolute brutality and the fear that these murders put into people. And I would be very surprised if Paula Denyer got parole, but I know that the newspapers will be, you know, publicising it widely when she's up for parole. How long away is it? Is it five years?
It's 5 years, and we need to be very, very afraid. And if you saw, as a lot of people did because they were featured in news clips and on documentaries, if you saw Paul Denyer's confessions 25 years ago, the only emotion that he shows during the, you know, 8 hours or something of interviews is when his absolute hatred and loathing of women. Mm. And this is why I find his identifying as female as an interesting component. Mm. My first thought when it happened was, I thought, he wants to get into a women's prison. He wants to be surrounded by victims. And look, I think our understanding, this is a decade ago, our understanding of gender identification has changed a lot. And if she now identifies as Paula, if she now identifies as female, I'm no expert. Maybe a psychologist might argue that Paul Denyer 25 years ago was trying to kill, you know, tokens of women because he was feeling like he might be a woman. I don't know. I don't understand. None of us can understand the complexities of the way that Paula Denyer is thinking or feeling. What I do know is that she does not get what she has done. She just doesn't. I got a letter from Paula a couple of years ago, and she expressed to me that she didn't want to cooperate with any book on the project because this case was still upsetting to the families and to her. And I thought, how could you put yourself in the same categories in terms of feeling sad about all of this as the families? And then she wrote, I don't want to cooperate with any book because I want to write my own true and unbiased account of what happened.
It
beggars belief. It is totally, but at the same time shows us, and certainly showed me, she doesn't get it. She can't even begin to understand. And then finish the letter with, after all, I just want to make this world a better place. Anyway.
We're not going to stop talking about these crimes because they're such a huge part of, I guess, Victorian, you know, criminal history. Now, Bart actually grew up in Frankston, didn't you, Bart?
I did, yes.
And so, Bart, as a young man, I was interested in asking you about, you're not of the age where you'd remember these crimes, but you knew about them.
I did. My parents were not in Frankston when these murders occurred, although I first learned about it in high school, actually, because I read this book. And I'd heard the name Paul Denyer said by a couple of my teachers referring to the history of Frankston. And when I went to Frankston High School, one of my Australian history teachers did briefly discuss it. And I, you know, then went on the Wikipedia rabbit hole to look through it. But it's not something that we were actively taught, and it's not something I'd say that is in our immediate memories, although certainly the generation before me had very vivid memories of the media circus surrounding it, as well as just the general coverage and hysteria during the time of the crimes.
Thanks, Bart. We like to ask Bart. He knows a lot of stuff. He's a young guy, but he's an old soul, and he knows a lot of things, and he reads Pretty much everything that we cover. Everyone needs a Bart. I know. He knows the peninsula quite well. Now, we want people to read about baby Jake in the book, but can you tell us a little bit about what's happening for Jake now, or how is life for him?
When people ask about baby Jake, there's a light of hope in their eyes to think, did it all turn out well for this poor child? And this is the real world and it's not fiction. And he described his dad, he adored his dad, and he said that his dad did the best job of raising him with the limited toolkit, if you like, that he had to possibly cope with what happened. So Jake described his dad drowning his sorrows at the bottom of a beer glass and trying different drugs, and all of it, Jake now sees, was to numb the pain. He just needed to be numb. He couldn't deal with what happened. Jake tells a really sad story about the day that he realised he didn't have a mum. And it might seem like a silly notion to people, but he'd never thought about it. And it wasn't until he went to school one day and he was in, I think, grade three, and one of his little friends had said, how come you walk to school on your own? How come your mum doesn't walk you to school? And it occurred to Jake that he didn't have one. And while his dad had repartnered several times and he'd had women at home, he'd never referred to them as mum. And so he described having a complete meltdown, and he was taken off to the principal's office, who'd rung his dad, who'd rung Gary, and Gary came up to school. They had a closed-door discussion and Gary walked Jake home again, and Jake said it would have been the best time to say, here's what happened to your mum. But Gary didn't explain it. And so Jake, it was referred to by his family in very vague terms, like bad things happen to good people and, you know, mum's in heaven. But it never had any solid base for Jake to know exactly what happened. So, you know, he was really left in the dark, and I think he would talk about how he suffered from, you know, many years of not knowing. And he said to me, how could I tell other people when I didn't know myself? Mm. If someone said, what happened to your mum? And I think that, you know, he talks a lot about the importance of telling kids the truth. As an adult, I think it's hard to think, well, how do you sit a kid down, a little kid down, and say, gee, mummy met a serial killer, you know? How do you even begin to do that? And my heart goes out to the adults in his world, because they were protecting him, but he was dying inside because he didn't know, and he didn't know what happened. He also talks about when he was 15, his dad had an accident. They were out motorbike riding in the bush, and his dad had sort of crested this really steep hill, thinking that it flattened out at the top, and it didn't. And his dad had sailed over, and he remembered watching his dad disappear and thinking that can't be good, and sort of screaming around to the other side of the hill and going up. And Gary had come off the motorbike and was really severely injured. And Jake describes the blind panic of rushing to the road on his dirt bike and trying to flag down someone that could help them. So Gary became a quadriplegic and has since died of that. So I think for the people that wanted the happy ending desperately for baby Jake, it didn't work out like that. He's now lost both parents, and you know, he's suffering the brunt of his upbringing and his mother's death.
It's so just the profound sadness of everything. And you know, you spoke to Natalie's parents for the book.
Yes.
Because they'd been fairly quiet, hadn't they?
Well, the Aunt Bernadette, Carmel Russell's sister, was the spokesperson. Mm. And Bernadette, I was looking through photos for a book that I've got coming out later this year on my 25 years of crime writing. And there's me with my knife cutting my 30th birthday cake. And there's Bernadette standing right next to me helping me. So this convergence that happens when you're a crime writer, and then you meet these really decent, lovely people who become advocates for, you know, that they were going to live a normal life, and all of a sudden they are doing Neil Mitchell's radio program and in the Herald Sun and having meetings with the Attorney General, because they have, you know, they become advocates for law and order, and they were just regular people. And her and I became really terrific friends, to the point where when she was diagnosed with bowel cancer at 54, she rang me and she said, could I come around and could you help me write my resignation letter, because I'm going to die from this. So this, as a writer, you know, sometimes I've never been in my own stories. This was never about me. It was always about the story. But that's not to say in the background that you're not a big part of the ongoing story. Mm. So when I rang Carmel and Brian Russell answered the phone and he said, I'm so glad you rang, because he said, I was just saying to Carmel, we need to use the 25th anniversary to get this into the public mind again, to remind people that in 5 years' time, Paula Denyer may be before our parole board. And so they were very, very happy for me to come over and have a chat. And so I was able to represent their ongoing story and their ongoing sadness in the final chapters. And when the book was printed, you know, when it was hot off the press, I went round for another cup of tea and gave them lots of copies, because last time when we'd brought it out for the 20th anniversary, they'd loaned their copy to someone and they didn't get it back. Yeah. And I said, all right, this time I'll bring you lots of copies so that you are able to loan it out, but not be, you know, not to not have it yourself.
So they'll be, who will be the people there when Paula Denyer is up for parole? Yourself, Brian and Carmel?
Well, you know, I wrote this book before social media. So it was interesting to hear when you're borrowing it as a young girl from the library and finding it so profound. I think maybe today you might have gone online and said, hey, Vicky, I really love this book. But 25 years ago, that didn't exist. And so I write my books largely in a vacuum, and I work full-time as a teacher, and this is something that writers do not get a lot of, or true crime writers, I don't know, I don't get a lot of feedback from readers. So it's always delightful to hear that this made a difference in somebody's life or had an impact. And nowadays, I think with social media, recently I was contacted by someone who runs the Frankston Community webpage on Facebook, and they have 14,000 followers, and her name is Kathleen, and she said, could I help with the memorial? Could we arrange flowers? Could we, what can we do? And so she, and we organised that on the anniversary of Natalie's murder, that the Russells go down to the bike track, and they've done that every year. Mm. And so she said, well, could we come down as well, and could we advertise that on the community page? Because she can feel, as I can feel, that Frankston has this huge connection with what happened. Mm. And when I do book signings, or I've booked two massive talks at the Frankston RSL that have booked out really quickly. Mm. And when I do signings afterwards, it seems that everyone has a story. Everyone that comes up says, my next door neighbour's best friend's cousin knew so-and-so, or they might be part of the SES who helped search for the bodies, or they might be neighbours, or they went to John Paul College. Everyone has a connection. Mm. And so I hope that with the strength and power of public media and podcasts like this, that I'm not the only one, that Brian Russell isn't the only one, that baby Jake as an adult isn't the only one. He said to me, and I use this line in the book, he said, you know, when I'm able to get work, he's finding it difficult to get work at the moment. He said, when I'm able to get work, thoughts of revenge quieten.
Mm.
And I hope that perhaps people turning to him with sympathy, and people turning to him and saying, we know what you went through, because he doesn't live in Victoria, so I don't know that he gets that.
Mm.
So we're trying to get him. We've invited him to come over for the anniversary. I don't know that that will be possible, but I'm certainly encouraging him to come to the place where everybody will look at him and understand what he's been through.
Yeah.
Without even knowing him, they understand.
And because you have a contact with Jake, I mean, if anyone, any listeners are able to offer any support, or I don't know what,
Well, we're going to set up a GoFundMe page.
Oh, that'd be good. We'll be able to promote that.
We want to set up a GoFundMe page to invite him over. It would be without the promise. I said to him, there would be no pressure, because this is obviously very intense for him, very, very intense.
Mm.
And he said to me, I don't know if I'll be able to hold it together in front of Natalie, because Natalie's parents invited him. They said, do you think baby Jake, and they refer to him as baby Jake, even though he's no longer a baby, but they said, do you think baby Jake would come over and join us for Natalie's anniversary to commemorate all the women? And I put it to him and I said, but there is no pressure, because he said, I don't know if I could hold it together. And I said, you know what, if you didn't, those two people in all the world would understand better than anyone.
Yeah, maybe, you know, someone could help him with an offer of a job, or just to get some stability. And
yeah,
so
he wants to work, and he wants to settle, and he wants to, and he's so clever and articulate. And I actually showed some of his messages to a writer friend of mine who I'm doing a PhD with, and I said, it's not just me, is it? This kid has such potential as a writer.
Mm.
And she just read one of the texts and she said, oh, my God, you're right. Mm. She could see it too. And I would love to, and I've offered, if he wanted to tell his story, to help mentor him through that. I don't think he's ready for that yet.
Mm.
But if the Frankston community, or if Melbourne could give him any kind of chance, I just think, you know, out of crime, always, no matter how bad it gets, the pits of despair, what happens is the community rallies, because people are good. They are not like like Paula Denyer. And the community rallies, and I think if they could rally around baby Jake, I think to me that's the fairy tale ending to this awful story.
Absolutely.
Is if he could get new life from the embrace of the community.
I feel like I'm quite speechless whenever I think about this. But thank you so much, Vicky. So the book is out. It's the Frankston Murders Revised Edition, 25 years on, and it's through Clandestine Press. But thank you, Vicky. You certainly have got a real following with our listeners, and you're having, we joked before saying you're an overnight success. You're not. It's 30 years in the making, but you are having quite a moment at the moment with your various incredible books, and the Phillip Island Murder is back out. And we got a lot of feedback after that podcast. So, yeah, we will definitely love to have you back. You're a friend of the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
And this really is an incredible book. Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime. And thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.